Wellesley, Massachusetts. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa laqad ba'athna fi kulli ummatin rasulan an i'budullaha wajtanibut-taghut. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ هَدَى اللَّهُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ حَقَّتْ عَلَيْهِ الضَّلَالَةِ فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ عَاقِبَةُ المكذبين. إن تحرص على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين. وأقسموا بالله جهد أيمانهم لا يبعث الله من يموت بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون. بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر ترى الناس لا تعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And certainly we raised in every nation an apostle, saying, Serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them who Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejecters. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not guide him who leads astray, nor shall they have any helpers. And they swear by Allah with the most energetic of their oath, Allah will not raise up him who dies. Yeah, is a promise binding on him, quite true, but most people do not know.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Forces kill another Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank, taking the death toll to over 200 since the start of this year. The Syrian president rejects direct talks with his Turkish counterpart. Assad says Erdogan seeks to legitimize the presence of his forces in Syria. An elite classified document shows the U.S. pushed for the removal of former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan over his neutrality in the Ukraine war. Welcome, everybody. Israeli forces kill yet another young Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The victim has been identified as Amir Abu Khalifa. The regime's forces fatally shot him in Zawada, a town in the Nablus governorate. Israel has been carrying out deadly raids across the occupied territories almost on a daily basis. More than 200 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli assaults since the start of the year. As the world marks the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, the plight of indigenous Palestinians remains an ongoing concern. Hundreds of thousands of indigenous Palestinians forced to leave their homes upon the creation of the Israeli apartheid regime in 1948 still continue to endure hardships. Ashraf Shannon has more details in this following report.
As the world marks the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples, over 5 million Palestinian refugees are still displaced and are scattered all over the world. In 1948, Israeli forces uprooted hundreds of thousands of indigenous Palestinians from their ancestral lands and replaced them by Jewish settlers. Some 1.3 million Palestinian refugees live in the Gaza Strip and reside in 8 refugee camps under miserable living conditions. The majority of Palestinian refugees in Gaza are grappling with poverty and rely on aid from local and international agencies to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates are very high among Palestinian refugees in the tiny seaside city.
One day we will return to our towns and villages. We have been living in harsh conditions for 75 years amid the silence of the international community. Poverty, unemployment, and sickness are widespread among the refugees. Just look around you. Our living condition is miserable. Israel is responsible for our suffering.
Press TV visited the house of Shwekar Dola, an 85-year-old refugee from the Palestinian city of Jaffa, currently known as Tel Aviv. Shwekar, who lives in the Shati refugee camp, says she has not lost hope of returning to Jaffa.
In 1948, Israeli forces attacked our city and started killing people, including women and children, and I lost many members of my family. My family escaped to Gaza, and I was only 10 years old. We have been living in the refugee camp for 75 years, but I still have the dream of returning to my city, or at least being buried there. Even if I don't return, my children and grandchildren will return.
In 1948, 85% of the Palestinian population faced displacement and disposition, and over 500 villages were destroyed, a somber chapter in the establishment of the Israeli regime. Officials have been repeatedly calling on the international community to help the Palestinian refugees.
The Israeli occupation has made life unbearable for Palestinians since 1948. On this day, indigenous Palestinians continue to live under dire humanitarian conditions after decades of losing their towns and villages, and Palestinian refugees are still scattered in refugee camps. Palestinian refugees were forced at gunpoint to leave their homes in 1948. Sincere international action is needed to help Palestinian refugees.
Palestinians continue to suffer under Israel's occupation and constant human rights violations since 1948.
After more than seven decades of displacement, Palestinian refugees say they hold sacred the right to return to their original lands. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has ruled out the possibility of direct talks with his Turkish counterpart as long as Turkish occupation forces are present in the Arab country.
Why would Erdogan and I meet? To drink beverages? Our goal is Turkey's withdrawal from Syrian territory, while Erdogan's goal is to legitimize the presence of Turkey's occupation in Syria. Therefore, the meeting cannot take place under Erdogan's conditions.
He made the remarks in an interview with Sky News Arabia. Assad said terrorism is the reason behind the destruction in Syria. He added that those who supported terrorists and brought the war on Syria are responsible for the country's current situation, not those who fought against terrorists. On Syria reconstruction efforts, Assad said the biggest obstacle to return to the return of millions of refugees is lack of infrastructural facilities, which were devastated by over a decade of war. He said it takes time to revive the Syrian economy and trade.
The biggest obstacle is the destruction of the infrastructure by terrorists. The biggest obstacle is the image of war in Syria that prevents any investor from coming to deal with the Syrian market. The biggest obstacle also is that you can destroy economic relations in weeks or months, but you need years in order to restore them. So it's unrealistic to expect that these relationships, which have begun to look closer to normal, would lead to economic results within months.
Assad added that the U.S. sanctions are another major obstacle to reconstruction efforts, although Syria has managed to bypass them in many ways. On Israeli attacks on Syria, Assad said the attacks are carried out under the pretext of countering Iranian presence, but they in fact target Syrian army. He said the Israeli strikes started when Syrian forces began to achieve victories in their battle against terror groups. U.S. media say a leaked classified document shows Washington pushed for the removal of former Pakistani premier from office over his neutrality in the Ukraine war. The Intercept says it obtained the document from an anonymous source in the Pakistani military. It says, or rather shows, that the U.S. State Department officials used threats and promises to encourage Imran Khan's removal. The report added that U.S. officials threatened Pakistan with isolation if Khan was to remain in power and promised, quote, all will be forgiven if he were removed. This issue was discussed in a meeting between the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S. and two State Department officials in March 2022. 1 month later, a no-confidence vote was held in the Pakistani parliament, which led to Khan's removal. Pakistan is currently in the midst of a political crisis after a district court sentenced Khan to 3 years in jail and barred him from politics for 5 years. Pakistan's parliament has been dissolved on the recommendation of Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, making way for a general election amid political and economic crises. The dissolution comes a few days ahead of the end of the parliament's five-year term. It will be followed with a caretaker administration to be picked by Sharif and an opposition leader to hold new elections in 90 days. The vote, however, could be delayed several months, with the Election Commission set to start redrawing hundreds of constituencies based on a fresh census. Analysts have said any delay in the election could fuel public anger and add to uncertainty in the cash-strapped country. Pakistan has been grappling with economic crisis and record-breaking inflation as the government implemented painful reforms to secure funding from the International Monetary Fund.
Wednesday was Pakistan's coalition government's last day of power, as Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif wrote to President Arif Alvi and called for the dissolution of the National Assembly, the lower house of the parliament. Addressing the farewell session of the parliament, Sharif, who was chosen as a prime minister in April last year after his predecessor Imran Khan was ousted in a no-confidence vote, thanked all legislators for their faith in him. The outgoing premier also criticized the policies of Imran Khan's government and blamed it for the current worsening economic situation of the country.
We had to bear the burden of the past regime's negligence and failures during our 16-month rule. The previous government had damaged Pakistan's reputation by violating the agreement signed with the International Monetary Fund.
The expected move to prematurely dissolve the parliament follows Pakistan's top electoral body's decision to bar the former Prime Minister Imran Khan from holding public office for 5 years. The electoral authorities' Tuesday's decision came as Khan was sentenced to 3 years in prison for corruption on Saturday, calling Khan's disqualification from office a punishment for his actions. Some parliamentarians said that the former PM is reaping what he has sowed during his tenure as a PM.
Whatever is happening at the moment with Imran Khan is due to his hostile policies towards his political opponents. His ego and pride not only put him behind bars, but also pushed Pakistan into the dark clouds of uncertainty and political unrest.
Some lawmakers think that all political parties, including Imran Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party, should be allowed to take part in the upcoming general election.
The current circumstances in the country will lead to the mistrust of the public. Whatever is happening with the PTI party at the moment is not right. Every political body should be provided free space to conduct its election campaign.
Under Pakistan's constitution, if the National Assembly completes its term, elections should be held in 60 days. But in case of its premature dissolution, this period is extended to 90 days. A caretaker government that will oversee the election is likely to be set up in the next 24 hours. Pakistan is all set to hold fresh elections in the coming days. Experts believe there will be a question mark on the credibility of upcoming polls in the absence of the country's two most popular leaders, Imran Khan and his arch rival, Nawaz Sharif. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has arrived in Pretoria to attend the 15th meeting of the Iran-South Africa Joint Economic Cooperation Commission. The commission is slated to meet on Thursday in its first gathering since the outbreak of the COVID pandemic. The top Iranian diplomat is also scheduled to sit down with his South African counterpart and the country's president. His trip comes ahead of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's visit to South Africa later this month. Raisi has been invited by his counterpart to take part in a BRICS summit there. South Africa currently holds a rotating chairmanship of the bloc that consists of five major emerging economies. The bloc will hold a summit of its heads of state in Johannesburg. Iran launched its bid for BRICS membership last year.
Iran has hosted a conference dubbed Iran and BRICS Prospects for Partnership and Cooperation at the Foreign Ministry's Institute for Political and International Studies in the capital, Tehran. Officials from the ministry, as well as a group of foreign ambassadors residing in the Iranian capital, participated in the event, which aims at identifying mutual capacities between the sides. The BRICS group of fast-developing economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, is often seen as an alternative to Western economic and political hegemony. It accounts for 42% of the global population and about 26% of the world's economy. Addressing the conference, Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian highlighted the significant role of BRICS in driving global economic growth, saying the Islamic Republic can be a reliable and influential partner of the five-member bloc of emerging economies.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is a reliable and effective partner in bilateral and multilateral cooperation due to its unique geostrategic situation and geographical location. It has massive energy sources, especially petroleum and gas, and it has an inexpensive and short transportation channel. The country has young, skilled, and professional workers and new and innovative scientific and technological resources.
The foreign minister hailed the favorable state of Iran's political and economic relations with BRICS members and underlined the need for all sides to further boost economic ties. He also stressed that BRICS represents a powerful economic and political synergy with the potential to influence regional and global developments. The BRICS summit will be held in Johannesburg, South Africa, on August 22nd to 24th. According to South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor, among the topics to be discussed at the BRICS summit will be the organization's expansion. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has received a formal invitation from South Africa to attend the summit. Iran is among dozens of countries that seek membership in the BRICS and has submitted a formal application to join the body.
As a result of a global shift away from unilateralism, more and more countries have joined or seek to join international economic mechanisms belonging to the multilateralism front, including the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS Group. In the case of Iran, it has been the main bulwark against hegemonic schemes in the West Asia region. Therefore, it has been part of this growing trend.
For decades after the Cold War, the world witnessed a U.S.-led unipolar hegemonic order. In recent years, however, a new multipolar world order has been emerging, with certain countries challenging the U.S.'s economic and political dominance. Also, perceptions of American arrogance and hypocrisy are widespread. Trust in the international systems that the U.S. helped invent and has presided over since World War II is long gone. After two decades of bloody military interventions across the West Asia, namely in Afghanistan and Iraq, the United States has lost much of its moral credibility as well. Russian and Chinese leaders have long expressed a desire for a more multipolar order, as have the leaders of emerging powers such as India or Brazil. So has Iran. And for the Islamic Republic, BRICS can be the next significant target of its multilateralism policy. According to the latest data released by the Islamic Republic of Iran Customs Administration, the value of Iran's non-oil trade with BRICS group of countries hits $38.43 billion in the 2022-2023 fiscal year, showing a 14% hike compared to the same period a year earlier. That's while the West, particularly the U.S., have imposed several rounds of unilateral sanctions against Tehran. Many states have been applying for membership in international bodies in a bid to promote multilateralism and counter unilateral policies. In addition, last month, Iran gained full membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the world's largest regional organization in terms of geographic scope and population. In an address to a meeting of the Friends of BRICS foreign ministers in Cape Town in June, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Iran is among the pioneers of multilateralism. He added that the era of unilateralism is coming to an end and that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS group of countries will play major roles in the future as a new world order is emerging.
Elsewhere, Russia says that it has downed 11 Ukrainian drones near Crimea overnight and two more flying toward the capital, Moscow. The Russian Defense Ministry said the two drones were shot down near the city of Sevastopol off the Crimean coast, and another nine were intercepted and crashed in the Black Sea. The ministry added that there were no reports of damage or casualties in any of the affected areas. The strikes come a day after Russia said two Ukrainian UAVs were shot down over an area near Moscow. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials reported the destruction of a fuel depot by Russian drones in the west of the country. The two countries have intensified cross-border drone strikes in recent weeks. The North Korean leader has called on the country's armed forces to prepare for the possibility of war by boosting production of weapons. Kim Jong-un made the remarks in a meeting with the military top brass. He ordered the military to conduct more deals with the country's latest weapons and equipment to keep its forces ready for combat. Kim also released the North's top general, who had held the post for about 7 months. The new development came following Kim's last week visit to weapons factories, in which he called for production of more missile engines, artillery, and other weapons. North Korea is set to mark the 75th anniversary of the country's foundation by staging a parade on September the 9th. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Scientists have raised alarm over unprecedented global ocean heat. They say the global average ocean surface temperature is expected to rise even further in the coming months as El Nino strengthens. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Common Dreams wrote, climate scientists have recently said the rapidly rising temperature of the planet's oceans is cause for major concern, particularly as policymakers in the top fossil fuel emissions-producing countries show no sign of ending planet-heating oil and gas extraction. The European Union's climate agency, Copernicus Climate Change Service, reported recently that the average daily global ocean surface temperature across the planet reached 20.96 degrees Celsius, breaking the record of 20.95 degrees Celsius that was previously set in 2016. The record set in 2016 was reported during an El Nino event, a naturally occurring phenomenon which causes warm water to rise to the surface off the western coast of South America. The weather pattern was at its strongest when the high ocean temperature was recorded that year. El Nino is forming this year as well, but has not yet reached its strongest point, suggesting new records for ocean heat will be set in the coming months and potentially wreak havoc in the world's marine ecosystems. Samantha Burgess, deputy director of Copernicus, told the media that March is typically when the oceans are at their hottest. She told the outlets, "The fact that we have seen the record now makes me nervous about how much warmer the ocean may get between now and next March. The warming oceans are part of a feedback loop that's developed as fossil fuel emissions have increasingly trapped heat in the atmosphere." Rising levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are warming the oceans, leaving them less able to absorb the emissions and contributing to intensifying weather patterns. Warmer sea surface temperatures lead to a warmer atmosphere and more evaporation, and both of these lead to more moisture in the atmosphere, which can also lead to more intense rainfall events, Burgess said, adding, "And warmer sea surface temperatures may also lead to more energy being available for hurricanes. The warming ocean could have cascading effects on the world's ecosystems and economies, reducing fish stocks as marine species migrate to find cooler waters. We are seeing changes already in terms of species distributions. Prevalence of harmful algae blooms popping up maybe where we would not necessarily expect them. And the species shifting from warmer southern locations up into the colder regions as well, which is quite worrying." Helen Findlay, a biological oceanographer at the Plymouth Marine Lab in the UK, told the Evening Standard. She added, "We are also seeing more species coming up from the south, things like European anchovy or recently examples of Mediterranean octopus coming up into our waters, and that is having a knock-on impact for the fish that we catch and consequences of economics." Certain parts of the world's oceans provoked particular alarm among scientists in recent days, with water off the coast of Florida hitting 38.44 degrees Celsius, over 101 degrees Fahrenheit last week. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration told the British media that ocean temperatures in that area typically hover between 23 degrees Celsius and 31 degrees Celsius at this time of the year. Since scientists first began measuring ocean temperatures using satellites and research buoys about four decades ago, the global average sea surface temperatures has gone up by roughly 6/10 degrees Celsius. On social media, climate scientists urged news outlets to explicitly connect the rising ocean temperatures to fossil fuel companies and the policymakers who are enabling them to continue fueling the climate emergency, such as British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who announced more than 100 new oil and gas licenses in North Sea this week. New York Times also reported terrifying earth breakdown, but barely mentioned the cause is the fossil fuel industry, said National Aeronautics and Space Administration climate scientist Peter Kalmus. "The more we burn fossil fuels, the more excess heat will be taken out by the oceans, which means the longer it will take to stabilize them and get them back to where they were."
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
I am become death.
Part 3.
In the beginning, God created light. Based on the old Torah scrolls, Jewish rabbis believe that light was God's first creation. In the 20th century, physicists doubted the nature of light. Was light small particles moving in space, or was it like sea waves? According to Jewish rabbis, water was the second element created by God. Water, with its wave motion, was the first Jewish embodiment of matter. In Jewish mythology, creation was God's will to transform energy into matter. At the beginning of the 20th century, a Jewish scientist from Europe established the equation as his theoretical foundation in physics, a theory in which matter and energy were interchangeable with one another. Albert Einstein, like many other Jewish scientists, immigrated to America with the spread of Nazism and its threat against Jews. The war in Europe was over, but Japan was still resisting in Asia. The managers wanted only a controlled fission of plutonium, but Oppenheimer insisted that a full-blown nuclear explosion was required. Its code name was Trinity. Trinity means Jesus, God the Father, and the Holy Spirit. It was a central core of Christian beliefs. But did the Jewish scholars of the Manhattan Project mean a Christian Trinity? J. Robert Oppenheimer, in a letter to General Groves, mentioned a poem by Richard Slater Dunn, which started like this: "Batter my heart, three-personed God." Apparently, Oppenheimer did not intend to specify the reason for this naming. However, he may have referred to the three Hindu gods in addition to the Christian Trinity. One of the three gods was the destroyer Shiva, and the other was Vishnu, that was the destroyer of the worlds in the old epics. The third god was a creator god, or Brahma, similar to Jewish creation myths. But in front of him were gods with destructive forces. Scientists bet on the Trinity test. Some predicted that the bomb would not work. Some predicted its strength up to 45 tons of TNT. In the first days of August 1945, the United States announced the names of several cities as targets of airstrikes by spreading leaflets over Japanese cities. The Japanese people thought that they were just bombings of conventional weapons, and news of the invention of the nuclear bomb had not yet spread. The United States did not mention Hiroshima among the cities it warned, while Hiroshima was the first target of the Americans for nuclear bombing. The Americans chose the bomb, the little boy, for Hiroshima. On August 6, 1945, B-26 bomber took off from Northfield and flew 6 hours to Japan. B-26 bomber carried the little boy to drop it on Hiroshima. Japanese radars detected American planes an hour before the bombing. A red status report was immediately sent to the radio. Around 8 a.m., the radar operator announced that, surprisingly, there were only 3 enemy aircraft approaching the area. At that time, Japan had a shortage of fuel and aircraft and usually did not intercept small air formations. The Hiroshima anti-aircraft fire teams received the warning, but all the involved parties during the war were ordered not to shoot at a small number of enemy aircrafts, especially over big cities. By this order, they wanted to prevent conflicts over densely populated cities and decrease the number of civilian casualties. Based on this, and thinking that 3 American aircraft with conventional weapons were nearby, a regular warning was broadcast over the radio, asking people to immediately go to shelters if they saw American B-29 super fortresses. At 8.09 a.m., Colonel Paul Tibbetts, the operation commander and aircraft captain of the B-29, started the operation by preparing to launch the bomb. 6 minutes later, the bomb was ready to be dropped over Hiroshima. At 8:15 a.m., Little Boy atomic bomb was dropped over Hiroshima. The little boy, with 64 kilograms of uranium-235, took about 43 seconds to reach the height of 600 meters above the city from an altitude of 9,470 meters. Atomic bomb exploded 600 meters above Hiroshima. After dropping the bomber quickly moved away from Hiroshima's sky and flew 18 and a half kilometers away from the explosion site. The bomb was supposed to hit the Aoi Bridge, but due to the wind, it exploded 240 meters away and exactly on Shima Hospital. A few moments later, the operator of Radio Tokyo realized that the communication line with Hiroshima was completely cut. He tried to contact Hiroshima on another phone line, but it was unsuccessful. The situation was reported to the capital authorities, and 20 minutes later, the Tokyo Central Telegraph Office found out the country's main telegraph line had been cut from north of Hiroshima onwards. A train station situated 16 kilometers from Hiroshima sent unofficial reports of seeing a scary and unnatural explosion in Hiroshima. All reports were forwarded to the Imperial Japanese Army General Staff Office. The military also tried to contact units based in Hiroshima, but they tried in vain. There was no way to contact Hiroshima. Everyone was confused. The military experts knew there was no major air attack on Hiroshima, and there were no large ammunition depots kept in to cause great damage. So why did this city fall into silence all of a sudden? Why was there no response from Hiroshima? A young Japanese officer was ordered to fly to Hiroshima immediately and report on the situation to the capital. The high-ranking commanders believed that the official reports of seeing a terrible explosion were just rumors, and logically, there was no reason for that kind of blast. The young officer went to the southwest of the country, and after about 3 hours of flight, he saw a thick cloud of smoke instead of the city. In the evening light of that day, a view of a ruined city gradually emerged. The pilot and the young officer flew a few laps around the sky of Hiroshima, but they didn't know what had happened. A large rift in the city was still burning, covered in thick smoke. The reconnaissance aircraft landed in the south of the city. The temperature in the area was very high. About 70% of the city was completely destroyed, and the remaining 30% was broken down. At the end of the same day, Radio Japan announced that all living creatures in Hiroshima had been burned and turned to ashes. The explosion killed 70,000 people, and another 70,000 people were seriously injured. By the end of the same year, the number of victims reached 166,000 due to radioactive effects. By 1950, this number reached 200,000, and the President of the United States announced the use of a new weapon in a statement and said, "We may be grateful to Providence that the German atomic bomb project had failed and that the United States and its allies had spent $2 billion on the greatest scientific gamble in history and won." Truman then warned Japan, "If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth." Behind this air attack will follow sea and land forces in such numbers and power as they have not yet seen, and with the fighting skill of which they are already well aware.
"Let there be no mistake. We shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war. It was to spare the Japanese people from utter destruction that the ultimatum of July the 26th was issued at Potsdam. Their leaders promptly rejected that ultimatum. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth."
These words had the tone of the Jewish Bible, where it explains about the calamity and destruction of rebellious tribes. America planned to carry out a second nuclear attack on Japan on August 11th, and this time they chose a plutonium-239 bomb, but the attack was carried out 2 days earlier due to climatic conditions. The morning of August 9th, 1945, another B-29 bomber flew to attack the city of Kokura. But the climatic conditions over Kokura were not suitable. The pilot reported that the sky was 70% cloudy and the city was not visible at all. The B-29 bomber circled the city three times to find a suitable opportunity to drop the bomb, but it was cloudy and the B-29 bomber was running out of fuel. Finally, they decided to head toward Nagasaki. Based on the amount of fuel remaining and the climatic conditions, they decided that if Nagasaki was cloudy, they would go to Okinawa on the way back and drop the bomb in the ocean. The B-29 bomber reached Nagasaki at 11 a.m. and it was cloudy as well. The pilot decided to return, but he noticed that the target at 11:01 a.m. when part of the clouds moved away. The people of the city were about to be saved, but they had to host the fat man. ...43 seconds after the release of the bomb, heat equal to 3,900 degrees Celsius was released with a strong wind of 1,000 kilometers per hour. The explosion left 75,000 people dead. The Japanese creation myth was now reversed. First, it was matter, then the cloud, then light, and finally chaos and disorder. The formidable energy of the mythological gods destroyed nature. The same day Harry S. Truman went on, "I realize the tragic significance of the atomic bomb. Its production and its use were not lightly undertaken by this government. We thank God that it has come to us instead of our enemies, and we pray that He may guide us to use it in His ways and for His purposes."
It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies, and we pray that He may guide us to use it in His ways and for His purposes.
On August 15, 1945, Japanese Emperor Hirohito, in a declaration addressed to the Japanese people, "The enemy has begun to employ a new and most cruel bomb, the power of which to do damage is indeed incalculable, taking the toll of many innocent lives. Should we continue to fight, not only would it result in an ultimate collapse and obliteration of the Japanese nation, also it would lead to the total extinction of human civilization. Such being the case, how are we to save the millions of our subjects or to atone ourselves before the hallowed spirits of our imperial ancestors? This is the reason why we have ordered the acceptance of the provisions of the Joint Declaration. This means the Japanese surrendered. General Douglas MacArthur triumphantly entered Japan. Now the world was at the disposal of the conquerors of the war to create a new system.
Now restored to the world, and that God will preserve it always.
The thoughts and hopes of all America, indeed of all the civilized world, are centered tonight on the battleship Missouri. There, on that small piece of American soil, anchored in Tokyo Harbor, the Japanese have just officially laid down their arms. They have signed terms of unconditional surrender.
Oppenheimer was later removed from his position and politicians turned their backs on him. Although after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, Oppenheimer received a Medal for Merit from President Harry S. Truman, and France made him an officer of the Legion of Honor, but he never returned to his position. In 1965, Oppenheimer was diagnosed with throat cancer. He fell into a coma for 2 years and died at the age of 62. He once appeared in the camera and said with a hesitant face, "We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed, a few people cried, most people were silent." I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty and, to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds."
He should do his duty and, to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
In the limelight.
According to a new poll, public confidence in the U.S. military continues to decline, reaching its lowest point in over two decades. Only 60% of Americans expressed a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the military in a recent Gallup poll conducted from June 1st to 22nd. That's down from 64% who said the same last year. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, trust in the U.S. military itself is in decline, stemming from a variety of reasons and reflecting America's overall decline as a global superpower. Politico, in its recent article entitled "Americans' Confidence in the U.S. Military Lowest in Two Decades," poll finds, revealed that, regardless of political affiliation, be they Republicans, Democrats, or Independents, Americans view the U.S. military with far less trust than they have in over 20 years. The article notes that after 9/11 attacks in 2001, military confidence shot up and remained over 70% until declining beginning in 2021. This decline coincides with the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan that same year, which was seen as a debacle following two decades of what many Americans believed was an unsolvable quagmire. The poor performance of U.S. military planners and their civilian counterparts in withdrawing from Afghanistan led to the deaths of U.S. service members as well as Afghan civilians and left the nation in disarray. Less visible are the fates of tens of thousands of U.S. service members who were sent on multiple tours overseas to either Iraq or Afghanistan or both, suffered physical or mental trauma, and returned home only to find a system that put them on long waiting lists for inferior care or received no care at all. These men and women found civilian life difficult to adjust to after experiencing the surreal nature of combat and military occupation thousands of miles from home. These U.S. service members spent years of their lives away from their families and friends, fighting abroad for abstract concepts like freedom and democracy and to nation build, only to return home and see their own nation in steep decline. After contributing to foreign interventions abroad, which denied people from North Africa to Central Asia peace and prosperity, these U.S. service members likewise found the prospects of building a peaceful and prosperous life at home elusive. This has not been lost on the American people as a whole, who see their veterans neglected, mistreated, and forgotten about after fighting wars that more and more Americans neither ask for nor benefited from. Not only has public trust in the U.S. military declined, so has the U.S. military itself. The Wall Street Journal, in its article, The Military Recruiting Crisis, Even Veterans Don't Want Their Families to Join, noted a growing crisis facing U.S. military recruiters who are struggling to find qualified Americans who are both capable and willing to join the U.S. military even as standards are repeatedly lowered. Standards are lowered for two reasons: to attract more people who are otherwise unqualified to join the military,